What happens when a society worships success so completely that it forgets to ask what success is for? Patrick Bateman offers us an answer we'd rather not face. Living in 1980s Manhattan, this investment banker possesses everything the American dream promises: wealth, status, designer suits, and a pristine apartment overlooking the city. Yet something is profoundly wrong. Behind his meticulously crafted exterior lurks a void so complete that even extreme violence can't fill it. The novel shocked readers in 1991 with its graphic content, but its real power lies in holding up a mirror to consumer culture and showing us something monstrous staring back. In our age of curated Instagram lives and personal branding, this story feels less like historical satire and more like prophecy. Bateman's morning routine exposes the absence beneath his surface. He wakes among status symbols: a $14,000 sofa, a David Onyeka painting hung upside down, unnoticed, exercise equipment arranged like art. His bathroom ritual unfolds with religious devotion: 1,000 crunches wearing an ice pack, followed by elaborate cleansing. He recites product names like Incantations, Plaque's anti-plaque formula, Clinique face scrub, Herb mint facial mask, each a prayer to perfection. This isn't self-care, it's self-construction. His body becomes a project demanding constant maintenance. Breakfast requires precision: kiwi fruit perfectly ripe, Japanese apple pear unblemished, bran muffin from a specific bakery. His wardrobe receives identical obsession, cataloged to pinstripe width and tie texture. What makes this routine genuinely disturbing isn't its excess, but its joylessness. There's no pleasure, only compulsion and desperate conformity. Behind the immaculate facade, something hollow echoes. In Bateman's world, status wars rage over details invisible to outsiders. At Harry's Bar, colleagues debate whether tasseled loafers are affected with business suits, dissect proper tie knots, and argue sock-trouser matching as if lives depend on it. These aren't conversations. They're elaborate dominance displays through specialized knowledge. The infamous business card scene crystallizes this absurdity. When Bateman proudly reveals his new card, colleagues produce superior versions. His reaction is visceral. "I'm seized by a panic attack. My heart thumps loudly, my pulse races, I'm sweating profusely." The cards are virtually identical: bone, eggshell, or pale nimbus white with tasteful thickness. But microscopic differences become weapons. The subtle off-white coloring, the letterpress quality, these details trigger existential crisis. Masters of the universe have panic attacks over paper stock. Their actual work is never described, suggesting its irrelevance. They compete not through accomplishment, but through consumption and display, turning every interaction into a battlefield where the stakes are simultaneously everything and nothing. The novel's most unsettling motif is constant identity confusion. Paul Owen repeatedly calls Bateman Marcus, confusing him with colleague Marcus Halberstam. Bateman accepts the misidentification. Why assert an identity that doesn't exist? Despite their obsessive personal branding, he can't distinguish colleagues either. At close range, they remain indistinguishable masses of designer labels. This interchangeability extends everywhere. Women are described exclusively through clothing and physical attributes. At Nell's nightclub, three elite models wear identical, skimpy black wool knit dresses by Giorgio de Sant'Angelo, differentiated only by footwear. Even girlfriend Evelyn and secretary Jean become interchangeable parts. The confusion reaches its darkest expression when Bateman confesses to murdering Paul Owen, and his lawyer dismisses it because he had dinner with Paul Owen twice in London just 10 days ago. Individual identity is so tenuous that even murder victims can be misidentified. When worth is determined entirely by external markers, actual personhood becomes irrelevant. These characters have surrendered individuality to become perfect representations of their class, a horrifying uniformity that makes them essentially interchangeable. Bateman's violence mirrors his consumer obsessions. He describes his weapons designer knives, nail guns, electric drills, with the same reverence as his Valentino suits and Oliver Peoples glasses. In one notorious scene, he delivers a sophisticated critique of Huey Lewis and the News' Hip to Be Square while preparing to murder Paul Owen with an axe, maintaining his analytical composure throughout both activities. The novel's haunting question, do these killings actually happen? When he returns to Paul Owen's apartment expecting mutilated bodies, he finds it spotlessly clean and for sale. His confession is dismissed as a joke. Yet a taxi driver recognizes him as the guy who kills Solly, suggesting his reputation is real. This ambiguity serves a deeper purpose than plot trickery. If the violence is real, it indicts a society so superficial it can't recognize a monster in its midst. If it's fantasy, it reveals the murderous rage simmering beneath privilege's polished surface. Either way, the violence exposes the logical endpoint of treating people as objects, where the difference between metaphorical and literal killing becomes increasingly blurred. Bateman's facade crumbles as his mental deterioration accelerates. Drinking his own urine, laughing at nothing, sleeping under his futon, flossing until his gums bleed. The Patty Winters show becomes increasingly surreal, featuring talking animals or interviewing a Cheerio for an hour. Reality itself warps around him. Language fails completely. When Bateman tells colleagues, "I'm utterly insane," or "I like to dissect thralls," they continue discussing restaurants and fashion. When Evelyn demands a firm commitment, his brutally honest response goes ignored. "My need to engage in homicidal behavior on a massive scale cannot be corrected." She changes the subject to coffee and brunch. Characters talk at each other rather than to each other, using conversation as status display rather than connection. The climactic chase sequence after he murders a saxophonist, exploding police cars, gunfights, helicopter pursuits, has the consequence-free quality of the violent films he constantly rents. His desperate attempt to force the world to acknowledge what he is fails completely. His breakdown reveals not just individual psychosis, but collective madness, a society valuing appearance over reality, consumption over connection, status over humanity. The final scene returns to Harry's bar, where nothing has changed. Timothy Price reappears, genuinely disturbed about politics, but can't complete his thought. This glimmer of awakening fades as conversation fractures into the same disconnected snippets. When someone asks why, Bateman launches into a rambling, existential non-answer about what being Patrick means. He notices a sign. This is not an exit. This final line encapsulates the novel's bleakest insight. There is no escape from the system that created him. Despite his extreme violence, real or imagined, Bateman remains trapped in the same social circuit, having the same empty conversations, making the same reservations. His attempts to break through confession, violence, or genuine emotion, all fail. The system absorbs and neutralizes every act of rebellion. In our world of influencer culture and curated identities, we've all become amateur Patrick Batemans, constructing facades, competing over microscopic differences, defining ourselves through consumption rather than character. The novel's warning echoes louder now. When we reduce ourselves to surfaces, when we measure worth purely through external markers, we risk becoming hollow at the core. The question isn't whether you're Patrick Bateman. It's what part of yourself you're willing to sacrifice to maintain the perfect image.